Did you ever feel anything like this heat?
Okay, the following is an interview with Mr. Randolph Richardson by Bill Whitehill for the Kentucky Oral History Commission. The interview was conducted at Mr. Randolph Richardson's address at Main Street in Owensville, Kentucky on July 23rd, 1978 at approximately 6 o'clock. Mr. Richardson, would you first start into talking about the development of your family, where it came from, when you arrived here? And
well, the older generation came here probably in the late 1860s. My grandfather was a veteran of the Civil War, and they came here from Virginia, lost their holdings in the Civil War, and immigrated to Missouri. They were Mormons, and they went to Salt Lake City to join the Mormons there, and didn't like it, and started back to Virginia, and their oldest son became ill in what is now Montgomery County, and they stopped to nurse him, and he just had a lengthy illness and died, and his mother would leave his grave, so they settled there in Montgomery County. And there was a large family of that generation. As I recall, there was something like 12 children. That was my grandfather's generation. And he and one of his brothers, Uncle Paro Richardson, who was named for one of the Mormon prophets, I think, Harley Pratt, came to this county to go into the lumber business. They would buy up stands of timber, and my great uncle would run the sawmill, and my grandfather would build a grocery store, and this is how he happened to be here. And, my grandfather stayed on and in the county, and my father, I guess, was born here, I believe, was born in this county. He was very young when they came here. And my grandfather kept a grocery store and the land that's still in our family. And then my father came to Owensville and went into a grocery store here with Mr. Sam Estill. He's one of the old families that's died out. And, my father bought Mr. Estill out and stayed in that until his death. And then my mother and my brother, Parley Richardson, ran the grocery store until my mother retired, and then my brother probably still has the grocery. And we children grew up, all of us except my sister. There were five of us. I have three brothers and one sister. And my brothers and I grew up in the old counter grocery, and we were all meat cutters. Our father trained us to cut meat, and that was our job at the grocery. So and my oldest brother started cutting meat, and he trained my brother Jimmy Richardson, who's now an attorney. Jimmy trained Parley, who now has the grocery store. Parley trained me. We did that until we were out of high school.
What was your parents' name?
My father was Leslie Everett Richardson, and my mother was Gladys Ponder Richardson.
And where was this counter grocery store located?
Up on, so it's, the building is still on Sutter Street. It's called the Pocket. We have two pockets. This is one of the pockets. It's the old counter grocery next to a pool room up there. At that time we had sold beer here, and this old beer in the pool room. And at that time the grocery stayed open. Our business was mainly from the country people, and they'd bring their eggs in baskets. And I started out by counting eggs. That was the youngest one in the family would start counting eggs. Counted eggs and sold watermelons. That was my job at the grocery store. And I used to then stand outside on Saturday night and watch them fight in the pool. And they'd have a big fight. They'd all get drunk in there. You know, beer was sold, and they'd break out all the windows and beat each other half to death, you know, and the police were all down there. It was quite a novelty for me to watch the fights.
What were some of the prices of the store when you first started working in it? Like, what would a dozen eggs or a watermelon cost?
Like, watermelons were 10 or 15 cents, and eggs were about a dozen, 10 or 15 cents, I think we paid. And we clerked, you know, we had all the merchandise was on the shelf, and had a big pot-bellied stove. people would bring their list and ask for what they wanted, and we'd walk around to different places and store and pick it up and take care of them in that matter. And then they'd leave their things there, they'd go to the movie then. We'd have large crowds in town on Saturday night at that time, and we'd go to the movies and visit around the courthouse square. We would stay open until 12 or 1 o'clock, and they'd leave their groceries and they'd come back in and pick them up as they went home.
So this is a rather small store for...
It was about, it's the average size for this town of this size. There were three groceries at that time, and they were all about the same size and would do about the same volume of business. So.
Now, did they do any delivering of groceries?
Oh, yes. We had a daily delivery, and this was one of the chores of the younger members of the family. We would have to deliver them. People would bring their grocery orders in or call them in, and we would deliver them. They charged people that ran monthly accounts, and we would take the groceries to the homes here in town, or even out into the country. Some of them would come in like once a month at that time, these country people would, and they would buy a month's supply, and we would deliver them out into the country.
Back at this time, were the roads of such a condition that it was easy to get around?
Yes, we had no problem. And some of them that are now blacktop were gravel roads, but they were fairly well maintained. We didn't have any problem.
And were these groceries, were they delivered through what means?
Well, we had trucks. This, you know,
different types of trucks or cars.
My father had a truck. One of the early panel trucks, a little panel truck that we had, and pickup trucks.
Now, was there like an extra charge for the delivery?
No.
That was all included as part of the service.
Part of the service. They bought a large order of groceries while we gave them a plug or a twist of chewing tobacco. This is the men who use tobacco. They bought a large order. This is one of the little freebies that we gave them.
Now you mentioned that like the eggs and some produce like that would be brought in by a number of individuals from around the area. Where did like the other things come from, like the flour and the canned goods?
We had grocery companies, and we would Dad would send trucks to Cincinnati and Lexington, I think weekly, and then a few of the companies at that time delivered. But the supermarkets as we now have them were not in existence in this area. My brother started the first supermarket in town, and it was quite a discussion among the family about whether he should do that or not. And didn't think it would go over, you know, that he would not be successful. And of course, that was just the opposite. He was very successful. He started in the building that he and my mother were in at that time, and then later bought an adjacent building and operated that for a number of years, and then we built the building we now have.
Now, did your family have the counter grocery store during the Depression?
No. My grandfather had his country store during the Depression. I've heard many, many stories about that.
Could you tell us some of these stories?
Well, this was he had a sure enough old grocery store, and we had he and his brother that had operated the sawmill built twin houses right across the road from up on a little knoll, and the home that my grandfather had later became our home, and we children were all born in that home, and the home that my grandfather's death went to my mother, and my mother sold it to my oldest brother, and the home is burned, but my uncle's home that my grandfather took is still standing, and my father's sister and her husband live in there. But the old grocery store was directly across the road from that. There was a gravel road at that time, and we children would play around that. But the people then came by, there were no cars then. They came by horse and buggy and by wagon to get their groceries. And I can remember that he sold cloth. He had great bolts of cloth, and the women came in to buy material for their dresses and for their children's clothing. And he had two marks on this counter, an old wooden counter. And he had a mark on there that measured a yard, and he would pull out a yard. They'd tell him it went 3 or 5 yards, and he would that he sold shoes. He had quite a supply of shoes, and at the time the store closed, the old high heel lace up shoes at the vending were there. And again, people came then and bought some of them and buy a year's supply of flour, salt, and sugar. That was about all they would buy. But he had salt of 100 pounds. And come on in, Jerry, go on in. And it was just a general country store. And the people would bring their cured meats, their hams, and side meat, we call it. We'd bring it in and trade this for merchandise. There was a lot of bartering at that time. And they would bring, sometimes would bring corn, a wagon load of corn, and he would buy that. You know, he would take that and give them groceries for it. He would later take that to a mill and have it ground into meal, and then turn it and sell the meal. It was a general gathering place at that time. All the people in the community, the men especially, would gather around the stove in the winter, and then there was a long porch on the front of the building in the summer. They'd all gather down around back and chew tobacco and spit across the road, you know, to tell tall tales. But he, at that time, he was also engaged in farming. And, my grandmother Richardson, until her death, ran the farm. He took care of the grocery store, and she ran the farm and did a lot of the work in the grocery. And we children went to a two-room school at Mud Lick at that time. And went to school there until the schools were consolidated, and then we came to Orangeville by school bus. But as a child, I can remember we would go, we would stay away from school if during hog killing. I don't know whether you've ever heard of that or not, but this is when all of this slaughtering was done by the neighbors. They would gather at each other's farms and slaughter. My grandfather would kill 12 or 15 big hogs, and we children would get to stay at home and watch that. They had an old, what they called a scalding pan. It was, the sides were wood and the bottom was of tin. And they'd get this water boiling hot and then either shoot or knock the hogs in the head with an axe and cut their throats and gut them and throw them into, they'd throw them into this boiling water and then scrape the hair off. And they hang, they had a big affair that they, a big pole up on a contraption, and they'd hang all these hogs up and then gut them and trim them out. And the women would then make the sausage and render the lard, and then this meat was salted or smoked. And ours, most of ours was salted. And we had a it was called a smokehouse. Actually, it was a meat house. And, there were long tables that this, you lay a bed of salt on this table and then lay the meat on it and cover it with salt again. And this was left in that, depending on the weather, I think about 6 weeks, and then it was taken off and scalded, wrapped and hung in burlap bags.
Do you remember that any of the stories of the actual Depression era, like, was it extremely hard on the people around
here?
Yes,
it was extremely hard on the people in that community particularly. I've had a number of the older people now that told me that that my grandfather kept their families from going hungry during that period. And he extended credit to the families there until they were able to work and get money again. And I think the greater portion of them paid their accounts. I think when he closed the store, there were a few that hadn't. But there was no work to be had, and the people had to depend on their gardens and their cutting wood for heat. And a lot of them were without clothing, and they would give each other clothing, and they did the best they could until the Depression eased and they could get back to work.
So then, after that, your grandfather closed the store.
My aunt and uncle, my father's sister and her husband ran the store for a number of years, and then it was closed and has since been torn down, and there's a residence there now. But my father then did some trading around at that time and held a political office or two, and then went into this grocery store and stayed there until he died.
Do you remember what political offices he held?
He was a commissioner, a county commissioner. And then he had an estate job or two at that time, and I'm not sure of what they were. I was quite young when this.
You mentioned that you grew up in a two-room schoolhouse, or you went to a two-room schoolhouse.
Two-room schoolhouse.
And you came to Owensville for your high school?
Yes, well, I finished grade school and high school.
And did you go on to further education?
The only thing I've had is a bottoming school. Now it has a fancy name, I think, the School of Marksberry Science or something. Wild name, but it was in bottoming school. And that's the only education I've had.
So when you were growing up, what type of entertainment did you, or could you go to, or did they have available to them?
Well, we would occasionally come to as we got older, we came to a movie here in Orangeville, but prior to that, our annual pilgrimage was on Christmas afternoon to a theater in Mount Sterling. My father took us, and that was quite a treat for us when we were very young. But then we depended on the community for our social activities. And I think the women had quilting bees, and occasionally there was a dance in someone's home. But there just wasn't that many social activities. We depended on the family then. The families your family units were very strong then.
So the whole family would get together.
Families would get together, and they would get together for dinners, and this was quite often. And relatives that lived at a distance would come to visit for a week or 2 weeks. And, the children played the games that children play around home and in the community, and that was about it. And we went swimming in the creeks, and we had horses. My father always had horses for us to ride. We were children of the Depression, my family was. I was born in 1930, and the youngest son and my sister was born 2 years later. We all grew up during the Depression, and there wasn't much money, and we didn't have a lot at that time. We had always had plenty to eat and plenty to wear, but we were people of modest circumstances, as everyone was, definitely. But we had a happy home and a good home. Had good parents and good grandparents. We grew up with our grandparents, and there were three or four generations around all the time.
You mentioned that there was beside the old store here, there was the pool hall, and besides that, was the movie house here?
Yes, the theater here was going. Yes. I went every Saturday afternoon and watched Roy Rogers and Gene Autry on the front row.
What did it cost to go to
I think it was 10 cents.
10 cents.
Something like that.
And did they have refreshments like they have at?
Yes, had popcorn and candy. But at that time, I think it was popcorn was popped at home. The family had owned it, popped the popcorn at home and had a little paper bags that they got at the grocery store.
Do you remember who owned the...
Yes, it was the Denton family that lived next door here. And still owned the theater, still owned the Denton. Owned by Edgar Denton. Yeah.
Were there any traveling carnivals or fairs that came here?
Yes, they came here. We would have them all. We'd have one or two every summer. With the animal acts, and of course these were smaller affairs, they had nothing like what we had. But the children all looked forward to that.
So, you went into the mortuary business.
I started working in high school, part-time at a small funeral home here, and kind of wandered in and never wandered out. And left high school, my father thought it would be a good opportunity for a funeral business, so I went to school, to mortuary school in Louisville, and came back here and worked for a firm in Mount Sterling for a time, and then came and went into business for myself.
Whose funeral parlor did you work?
I worked for Barnes and Reynolds at that time, and they later went out of business, and after I got out of school, I worked in Mount Sterling for a funeral home for about a year, for the Mitchell Douglas funeral home. And then I came over, and a gentleman from Flemingsburg and I bought out the old Shrap Piper and Shrap firm, which had been in the family for two generations. And I later bought out Mr. Shrap. Owned it until couple of years ago, and then I sold half of it to one of the boys that worked for me.
So what were some of the things that got you interested in this business?
Well, I got interested in it to make money part-time when I was a student in high school when I wasn't working at the grocery. As I say, my father thought it would be a good business for me to go into. Our family's always been, I have a brother who's a lawyer. I guess that's a profession. I don't know. I sometimes wonder. And I have a school teacher. My sister's a school teacher. But our family have been business people. We haven't been professional people. I consider what I do a business in a sense. I guess there's a professional side to it.
How have you seen this business grow?
Well, it's changed to some, of course, during my since I've been in it, since the 50s, but I've known a lot of the older funeral directors and knowing the things they have told me. Embalming as such started during the Civil War. And I can't remember the name of the gentleman who started it. He was a Southern, was a Confederate soldier who started embalming the Confederate soldiers that were killed. And he did this to preserve them, to ship them home to their families. And, became widespread throughout the nation after the war. They started having embalmers, and usually these were people that had furniture stores, or they were cabinet makers, and they made the caskets, and so they would go out to the home and embalm the body and sell the casket to the people. And from that, they evolved into modern manner as the funeral homes. But up until, I guess, the early 40s, the embalming was done at home. They'd call and the undertakers would take their equipment to the homes and embalm the people at home. And prior to coming, usually they were laid out. If it was a woman, the women of the community would bathe and dress them and lay them out. The embalmer would come in and embalm them and come back later and bring the casket and have the funeral. They started then horse-drawn hearses were built. They would take their horse-drawn hearse, and this was quite an affair. You've never seen other than some of them had a pair of black horses with big red plumes or black plumes on the harness, and white horses with different colored plumes on the harness pulling this big horse-drawn hearse, and the undertaker and his driver would be in top hats and cutaways and this type of thing. Very fancy.
Back at this time, did the undertaker also was involved with the cemetery plot itself, or did they have a?
Not really. No, not that's separate, and that's and still is. You don't not involved in the cemeteries. Families at that time, most of the people had family plots out in there. There'd be a small burying ground in each community, and you would have the funeral either the church or at the home. A lot of them were at the home, and then just take them.
So a number of the people were actually laid out in the home itself, as opposed to having a funeral house.
Up until the early 40s, all of them. I started the first funeral home as such, the first one in the county.
Was it hard to get people to accept that, or were they willing to?
Well, no, they were willing to. I think they were ready for it. I think the people, my brother started the first supermarket. I started the first funeral home and such, and people, and we just happened to get it in the town when people were
When was your funeral home established as such?
In 1950. 1950. First, yes.
So that's been going on for almost three decades now. Mm-hmm. And have you seen a great or any type of change in those three decades?
Well, there is a change, of course, but not a great change in it now. Of course, then we had, when I started, we had a lot of our funerals were at the churches. A lot of the bodies were taken back home or laid out at home. We had a lot of that. But that's all changed. We don't do that anymore. And, 99% of the funerals are at the funeral home, and the bodies are left at the funeral home. We used to have to take all of our equipment, the chairs and all of this stuff, and take all of the flowers to the home and lay them out there. And then take them all to the church. And then when we started really getting a modern funeral home, I people realize that it would be more convenient to have it all in one place. So that's.
You hear of wakes. Do they have wakes around here?
Not as such, not that I think what you're talking about are Irish wakes and ethnic wakes. So no, we don't have that here. We have, usually the bodies are laid out at the funeral home for maybe one, like at 2 o'clock this afternoon. The funeral will be maybe the following day. Occasionally they're there for 2 nights, but usually 1 night, and the friends call and pay their respects that night, and the family's usually there to receive the friends, and the funeral service itself is the following day.
The some other countries have gone to the cremation or things like this, but that's not popular around here.
It's not popular. We occasionally have it, but it's not popular.
Now, like at your funeral house, do you have the facilities there?
No, none of the funeral homes in this area, I don't know, none of the funeral homes in the nation have the cremation facilities. There are crematoriums scattered throughout the nation.
Where would be the closest one?
Cincinnati or Louisville, there are crematoriums.
But now, you as a funeral director would handle all the arrangements of
transportation. Yes.
Now, if you were to take one to Cincinnati, now that's across the state border. Yes. Now, does that have any extra legal?
We have our documents that we have to take with us. You have to take what we call a burial transit permit, which allows you to go to the last state with them. You have them cremated. We wait, rather than being cremated, we wait and bring them back with us.
So there's really no great deal of trouble. No, it's just not, all no. A matter of paperwork.
That's all.
Thank you. What about we have the development of Cave Run.
Yes.
How did that affect, or how do people go about moving cemeteries, moving the bodies once they've been in the ground for a while?
You dig them up.
There's much more goes into just digging.
Really. You knew I did this, I guess.
No.
I have an application that sorts that this. I do cemetery relocation. I did this Cave Run cemeteries, which started me in this business, and I do this now nationwide, I guess you would say, mostly on the eastern seaboard.
Since I know nothing about this area, could you explain like all the things that you have to go into on preparation, safeguards, things like this that you have to do in moving a cemetery?
Is all governed by law, and the cemeteries that I move mainly are for the federal government or for the state governments. I work primarily for the Corps of Engineers and their development of lakes. If they build a lake, they move the graveyard. Excuse me. The cemeteries.
Well, like I've heard, and this may be all rumor, but people have to be maybe quarantined, or
it's all rumor. That's exactly right. It's all rumor. I think I've done one contract. Let me see, where was it? In Missouri, and we were required to furnish the government with a health certificate showing that the boys have been inoculated against tetanus and smallpox and what have you. That's the only time I've ever had that. I've never had anybody or never known of anybody that's doing this work to contract the disease from moving the body.
I see, because I was under the impression, I guess maybe I had
rumor
gotten this, that it was hard business to move.
Yeah.
Okay, if you go to a real, excuse me. Slide two of the interview with Mr. Randolph Richardson. Mr. Richardson, if you had to move a real old graveyard, the caskets are made out of wood. That's probably throughout the years gotten very rotten.
We find nails. Rusty nails, a little discolored dirt, occasionally a bone out of the old ones. Occasionally we'll find an old homemade casket that was buried maybe, say, in the 1860s. It'd be sitting there solid as it was the day it was put down there. A lot of the old homemade caskets were of oak and walnut, black walnut, and they have lasted. Occasionally they'll be there just like they were when they were buried. As a rule, they're gone. There's nothing there. But you can always tell there's been something. There's something left in all of them.
So some of them are relatively easy to move, as opposed to some that you might not find much at all.
Not much at all, that's right.
I've also heard that they used to build caskets that would have either a glass plate or something over the over the face area so that you could actually see the person in a closed casket.
That's true. I don't know if I still have it or not. I have a small child's casket with a glass plate. But we inactivated these graves, we found a lot of glass. These glass plates broken.
Was there, what was the reason behind having a casket built like this?
God knows. I guess that maybe a lot of them. Embalming wasn't that popular back at that time. This might have been to keep down odor. People smell. Human body smells just like a dog or a cat or an animal if they're not embalmed. And this is one reason you used to, like if a person died this afternoon, they'd be buried tomorrow. But then there was a terrible odor involved. And I assumed this was, the casket was closed like that to keep odor down.
So are there any other instances or things that you would like to tell us about your business that have changed from when you first started as a part-time help?
Not really. There hasn't been that much change other than the things that I've told you. But, it's evolving. Everything evolves, and I'm sure that in another 25 or 50 years it will be an entirely different story.
Another thing, maybe this area isn't as, it's not as common yet, but a number of areas are, they're almost running out of room.
Well, that's not true. But the statistics prove that there are as many graves abandoned each year as there are humans buried.
How are they abandoned?
Well, you drive out through the country and you'll see a farm with a tree with a little tombstone or two sitting around it, and that means the farm is plowed over. We encounter this in moving these cemeteries. People don't take care of them. Families die out. The community cemetery is abandoned, and nature takes over. And we move a lot of these that have been abandoned. Trees this large going in graves. Nature claims its own. We're not going to run out of room. There's always going to be enough room to bury people, and there's always going to be enough abandoned.
Have they ever considered around here of having a mausoleum?
Not a commercial mausoleum. There are a few private mausoleums built around in some of the cemeteries, but they're not popular, I think, because of the expense.
So it's much more expensive to put up a mausoleum, even if it was a large one for, say, the community.
Yes. It'd be more expensive than earth burial. But I can't anticipate that in the foreseeable future. I think we'll continue with earth burial.
Well, thank you very much.
My pleasure.